Good morning, it's Mitchell Thomas here from the Downstairs Care Out There blog, coming to you from Leeton in the Murrumbidgee Riverina area of Australia. I do apologise, it has been a little while between podcasts. I've spent some time relocating for work and moving myself and my partner down to Leeton. But now that we're down here and settled, the podcast should become a more regular thing, as well as the blog posts should be getting back off the ground. What I wanted to talk to you today about was just a quick podcast on the pre-hospital pelvic binding and traction splinting survey I ran recently through the blog. This all developed out of a conversation on Twitter, which eventually spilled over onto Google+, relating to how pre-hospital providers, be they paramedics, nurses, doctors, deal with pelvic injury with concurrent femur fracture, and what the world was doing on that. This was a really interesting conversation to be involved with on Twitter as well as on G+, because a lot of us circled around the fact that there really was no evidence for what we were doing, and once it came down to it, eventually I found where my services protocols come from, and they come from a document produced by the Institute of Trauma and Injury Management in New South Wales Health as part of their adult trauma clinical practice guidelines for the management of hemodynamically unstable patients with pelvic fracture. During the conversation occurring on G+, Min Le Cong put up a number of quite interesting papers and opinions on maybe why we shouldn't be doing this, and showed a number of papers that demonstrated in orthopaedic as well as trauma literature that binding the pelvis and application of a CT6 style splint were contraindicated. A number of trauma guidelines were brought forward that suggested that this was the standard of care that we apply, be they internal SOPs to organisations or protocols from quite eminent bodies on the management of trauma and resuscitation. But that's enough talking about this. We've really come to the conclusion that there's not a lot of evidence to support what we do, and that more evidence is needed before we can charge decisively ahead and say that's the way to manage a patient. I want to be clear when I talk about the application of pelvic binding and traction splints. I've only ever done it with a SAM-style device or a bed sheet as my pelvic binder. And I've only ever applied a CT6. I've never applied a hair traction or Donaway type traction splint to a pelvic fracture. It appears, just looking at the device itself, and this was the thing that I brought up during the conversation on Twitter and as well on G+, that the Donaway and the hair type traction splint displace the pelvis anteriorly more because of the device's manufacture. The CT6 style devices run in line with the leg and use a small webbing strap under the leg and up into the groin to provide the counterpoint for the traction. I've never applied a Donaway style or hair style traction splint, and I don't think, because of the movement involved in getting a patient onto one of those devices, that would be a good idea. However, based on what's been coming out through my survey, there are some services around the world that are doing that. I don't know what kind of results they're getting. If anyone out there listening to this is part of a service that uses a pelvic binder and Donaway or hair traction style setup, please get in contact with me. I'd love to talk to you. I'd be really interested to see how that works for you and how you feel it works, and whether or not it gets used a lot, because those splints are quite difficult to set up sometimes and do take a lot longer than the CT style of splint. For those of you unfamiliar with the style of splints I'm talking about, I'll put up some photos on the blog to accompany this. The other post that also accompanies this is called Pelvic Binding and Pre-Hospital Traction Splinting, Results of a Survey. And that's just me running through what I got out of my small survey that I ran. I'm not touting this as the latest and greatest in what we're doing, but it's just a brief snapshot of what people around the world are doing in terms of the responses that I got. Obviously, throughout the podcast here, I am going to refer to various types of manufacturers of splint. I take no money from any from any splint manufacturer or manufacturer of any medical goods. I purely and simply make the recommendations and observations based on the materials that I've used and what's out there on the market. Primarily in my day-to-day job, if I'm going to be doing pelvic splinting, it'll be with a bed sheet and clamps. For those of you unfamiliar with this process, you take a standard hospital linen bed sheet, fold it to about the width of a SAM splint, wrap that around the pelvis, apply traction with two operators pulling in opposite directions until taut, and then you use supplied large clamps to immobilize that sheet onto itself. In addition, our traction splint now is exclusively the CT6. We usually carry two of them in every car, and they're quite well liked over the old hair traction splint. They're quite quick to apply. So now on to the results of the survey. All in all, I had 75 respondents. Obviously, this was by no means exhaustive, and I didn't go too far out of my way to get responses. It was merely a couple of months of collection via Twitter and word of mouth. Respondents came from all over the world. We had Australia, various states, the UK, the USA, Canada, South Africa, Scotland, a couple from the Middle East, Ireland, and Sweden. Numerous brands of pelvic binders are being used out there. Most predominantly was the SAM splint model one, followed quickly by the T-pod bed sheet and clamps. A few were in there with the Prometheus binder, which is probably my favorite, if you haven't seen that, and a couple of people were using the KED. And the brands of traction splint were Donaway Hair, CT6, Sager, and Track 3, which I hadn't heard of before I started asking around. 88% of the respondents indicated that pelvic binding was indicated by their service and that they did have the equipment to perform it. 97.33% of respondents are using traction splints on indicated femur fractures without pelvic trauma. Now is where it starts to get interesting, when we start talking about pelvic fractures and femur fractures. This is where the field really split up again, like it did in the Twitter and G Plus comments. 48% of respondents indicated that their service did have a protocol for dealing with multi-trauma of the pelvis and femur. 32% indicated they had no guidance on what to do with patients with coexisting pelvic and femur fractures. 13% had a protocol that wasn't routinely applied by clinicians, and 16.18% indicated they don't have protocols, but providers have performed some kind of pelvic binding and femoral traction before. Well, which just went to show that really, the whole world is kind of spread out about this issue, probably because of the lack of solid evidence base to provide guidance, and probably because when we do this, we're just doing it on expert opinion. As I said before, we had a number of respondents in all sorts of fields of employment, beginning mostly predominantly with paramedics and flight RNs, students, a number of doctors from around the globe. And I'll just say again that this was no way intended to be exhaustive research, or in no way can it guide your practice. This was more just to gauge what was being done worldwide and try and build a bit of an idea of how other services work in relation to my service. I think that the issue of pelvic binding with femur fracture traction is something that needs to be explored more. I think it'll be very difficult to explore more, but I definitely think that if the wrong device is used or applied incorrectly, that there is possibly a significant risk of harm. My feelings on this matter come from playing the part of an injured person and having a Donaway splint applied to me, not tightly, mind you, but applied to me for the purpose of an exercise in extrication. And after about 45 to 50 minutes of being in this, I noticed that I was on a little bit of a slant and that my legs and abdomen had been moved up into the air more than they would have been if I'd been lying flat on the ground. I think the advantage to the CT6 is it allows you to keep the patient flat on the bed, and there's absolutely no interference from the device in shifting upwards towards the ceiling. That said, I believe that people are reporting that there may be a risk of harm from tractioning the femur against the pelvis. The CT6 does sit up in the groin and apply quite a bit of pressure to the base of the pelvis to use as the mechanism for tractioning the femur. A lot of people are suggesting that where value may come from splinting a pelvic fracture and a femur fracture concurrently is when the patient has absent pulse in the distal limb, or where there is significant bleeding from the distal limb. But in all cases, the devices that you are using need to be treated with a certain level of respect, and you need to understand what you're doing, and that an improperly applied or improperly over-tensioned traction splint could cause significant harm to this patient. In a case where there was no vascular compromise and we were just dealing with fractured femurs fairly close to a hospital, you could be justified in applying the pelvic binder and taking them very quickly to hospital, but that's probably not the patient we're talking about here. We're talking about a patient that has gross anatomical deficits, both legs out to one side, fractured pelvis from something like a motorcycle accident or compression and confinement in a car, who has the potential to deteriorate quite swiftly en route. There is a potential that over-tensioning a traction splint can cause the patient quite significant harm. This is in the setting of just using a traction splint for a mid-shaft femur fracture. I know the CT6, if you're not paying attention to it, is quite easy to over-tension because of the 4-to-1 mechanical pull ratio that it has on it. If you are new to the CT6, my one recommendation to you would be to learn how to manipulate that cord lock and cord so that you can just dial it through quite slowly between your thumb and middle finger. It applies very little movement, and you just need to move that cord lock and piece of cord very, very slowly to achieve optimal traction. You're not trying to pull start a lawnmower, and I've found that possibly the easiest way to avoid over-tensioning is just to concentrate on using that thumb and middle finger to slowly pull that cord through. There's a real danger that if you grab that cord with your whole hand that you're just going to misjudge the amount of force you're applying and pull that piece of cord quite a significant way. One thing that everyone did seem to agree with was tying the feet and knees for pelvic trauma to stop flexation and rotation. I know it's something that we often do. It's quite easy to do. It's just a few simple triangular bandages used to fix the knees and ankles together to stop them from moving around during transit and mobilizing that pelvic fracture by changing the shape and size of the surface that you've bound. Speaking of this, obviously, once applied, pelvic binders do need to be checked. If you're looking to find out more information about this, I'll post up a lot of the links that were supplied during the conversation on G+. Most of them are various SOPs from ambulance services and hospitals. There are a few opinion pieces and a few pieces of research that were found and provided by some of the people involved in the conversation. I'd love at some point to actually have a discussion with someone about pelvic binding and femur traction in the pre-hospital environment. It's something I've done very little of, but I'd really like to talk to someone who's done a lot of it. So on that note, I am drawing to the end of this little summary here. I just figured I'd put it down in a podcast form for those of you who haven't looked around at it or weren't involved in the original conversation. You can probably still find it on Twitter. I know that the G+ conversation started by Andy Buck is still up there, and that's where you can find all the evidence, but I'll post a link to the conversation and I'll post a link to all the evidence that was put up as part of that. As a final closing point, if you're a paramedic out there listening to this who is thinking about going to SMAC, that is Social Media and Critical Care, over in Chicago, it's well worth your time. Book leave now. I already have. I've bought a ticket. I'm ready to go. Now I just have to pay for flights and arrange the rest of the niceties, like places to stay and things to do. But I had the privilege of attending Smack Gold up at the Gold Coast earlier this year, and I had an absolute blast. I got to meet some wonderful people who I still keep in contact with today. I got to put names to faces, shake a few hands, and also learn so much from every presentation I went to. It is probably the best conference that you will ever go to in your life until the next one rolls around, and I would very much recommend getting yourself in there. It's a good excuse to go and see America if you haven't already, and a good excuse to go and meet some absolutely wonderful people and learn some absolutely fantastic things. That's been Mitchell Thomas for the Downstairs Care Out There blog, and I will speak to you next podcast.